This is The Review, a podcast from the Atlantic's culture team about movies, television, and all the things we make to entertain ourselves. I'm Spencer Kornhaber, a staff writer at the Atlantic. I'm joined today by two other staff writers on our culture team, David Sims.
Hello.
And Sophie Gilbert.
Hi, Spencer. Hi, David.
Hey.
How are you both doing?
I'm sick.
You're sick?
You're sick? Mm-hmm.
Sick of what?
Oh, no.
Well, not the COVID. Yes. Sick of you. No, just slightly sick.
Sick of your attitude.
No, I have a cold. It's fine.
Well, we'll be a little nicer to you today for that reason.
Please do.
Nope. I'm joking.
Today, we're talking about West Side Story. The classic 1961 film based on the classic Leonard Bernstein musical has been remade by none other than Steven Spielberg last year. It's nominated for 7 Oscars, and it's one of the last big films up for Best Picture that we haven't discussed on the pod. We haven't had our knockdown, drag-out fight about it yet, but we're about to. The reception to it hasn't been quite what many people in Hollywood expected. Some people love this movie, and some people didn't see this movie. So we thought we'd break it down a bit. David, can you explain why we have a West Side Story remake in 2021?
Sure. That's actually a fair question, because musicals in Hollywood don't often get remade, right? There's just so few musicals these days. So obviously this is West Side Story. It's probably the most well-known musical, right? Like sort of classic musical, maybe. Mm-hmm. It's certainly on the, you know, high end of that list.
It's this and Cats.
Well, one day we'll have another Cats. I'm sure someone will take a swing at it. In fact, Steven Spielberg considered making Cats long ago, but he wanted to do it animated, and Andrew Lloyd Webber didn't like that. But at the end of the day, might have been a good idea, considering what eventually happened.
Yeah, I want to live in Cats. That reality.
I would say there's two reasons. One is that Steven Spielberg has never made a movie musical, and he seems to be in this sort of, I don't want to say twilight, but in this kind of, you know, he's an older guy. He's been making movies for 50 years, and he's maybe trying to knock some things off that he's never done before. So he wanted to make a musical, and he wanted to make West Side Story as his favorite musical. It's a movie he talks about glowingly as like getting him into movies and all that stuff. Then the other reason is West Side Story, the original film, is, in my opinion, it's a masterpiece. It's a great film. It won Best Picture at the Oscars, but it's a bit of a tough watch today, mm-hmm. especially in high definition. Like, it's really tough to see this great film that is so iconically put together with people who are very obviously wearing brown face, like wearing, you know, thick makeup to look Latino, and they are not, you know, like, so it's one of those things where it's like, yes, of course it's a classic, but yes, one could argue also for an update.
Right. It's a bit of a passion project, but it's also like someone had to remake this at some point to fix that brown face problem.
Possibly. Right. I mean, maybe not had to, but certainly there's an argument.
Well, Sophie, you are a connoisseur of the musical as an art form. What did you think of it?
Oh, boy. I am conflicted because, like David, I love the original while really, really finding aspects of it they're very, very hard to take in this moment. And I have to say, there were things about this remake that I loved, particularly the dance sequences, the musical numbers. I think Spielberg is so good at what he does, and he really, I mean, David can talk more about the artistry of the scenes, but they're just spectacular. And this was, a movie where I really wished I'd seen it in the theater instead of at home on my TV.
Because
I think it would have made even more of a difference. But at the same time, I had some issues with this movie, and they mostly revolve around the central love story. And obviously, Stephen Sondheim wrote the lyrics for West Side Story, and his impression of it was always that it wasn't supposed to be a kind of piece of sociological realism. It was a love story. And more than anything, it's a love story to theater and what theater can do. It can kind of sweep you up in this great collaboration of dance and music and storytelling and sort of really pull you in with that. And yet in remaking the movie, I think for relatively obvious reasons, Tony Kushner, who wrote the script, decided to sort of enhance the sort of realism aspects of it and to get really at the heart of the gentrification of the West Side and the, you know, the different gangs and the socioeconomic reasons behind their discontent and their rumbling and their sort of wanting to fight each other, I suppose. But for me, what was lost was the love story.
Hmm. Well, so like what Spielberg's doing is really pulling out from the story, which is pretty self-contained and stylized take on a real world situation. The original movie was a series of music videos, really, like kind of dreamy.
It's very abstract.
Abstract, pastels, absolutely. Yeah.
Right. It's not set in a definable place.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's the West Side, you know, and it has that opening sequence. The movie, the original, has the opening sequence that's shot on location, but almost everything else is sound stages. Like, it's very obviously just, you know, film studios.
Yeah. And so Spielberg wants to pull out and be like, no, this is actually a story taking place at a particular time. And yeah, there's social commentary to be brought out from it and a sense of realism to be inserted and like a sense of scope and scale that wasn't in the original. Like, he really wants you to feel like you're in this giant neighborhood of Manhattan that's been decimated by gentrification. But in doing that, he's like roaming all over the place, and the sense of like these kind of gem-like musical numbers get kind of like lost that gem-like dreamy quality and searching for the creating the sense of scope and scale.
While the ambitions of sort of reforming the movie, quote unquote, I know that's not an ideal word, but like making it less problematic or giving, you know, its Puerto Rican characters greater depth and visibility on screen and more historical context and more accuracy in the telling of their stories. Like, those are really great ambitions to have. It's a very tricky existing product to kind of expand those, mm-hmm. like, those sociological parts of it, because again, it's not what the story was supposed to do. I mean, there's a whole number in it. Officer Krupke is all about like making fun of those kinds of like, those kinds of readings of characters, if that makes sense. Like, I think Sondheim said, they serve to remind the audience that this is entertainment, not a social treatise. And so if you try to make it more of a social treatise, which I think is a definitely a positive like motive to have, a good motivation to have, it keeps butting up against what the musical was designed to do. I mean, I want to talk about the origins of it, but because I find them so like fascinating and funny. Like, originally, I think Arthur Lawrence, who wrote the book, and Leonard Bernstein, who did the music, and Jerome Robbins, who directed the movie and did the choreography. Like, wasn't it originally supposed to be about New York Irish Catholics and New York mm-hmm. Jews in conflict, I think, at the week between Easter and Passover?
Yes. It was going to be set on the Lower East Side. Yeah.
Yeah. And then one day, like, Lawrence and Bernstein were hanging by the pool at the Beverly Hills Hotel, as you do. And they were like, I think, like, someone read a news story about gangs in Los Angeles, and they were like, I know, this is where we go with this one. Like, it was that much of a kind of pivot, right?
Well, the other thing that no one remembers anymore, but there was a very popular movie at the time, or sorry, a show, not movie, called Abby's Irish Rose, which was about an Irish-Jewish romance, like a Romeo and Juliet, a star-crossed. And they were like, oh shit, it's just that. Like, we can't do that because that's
we can't like go up against done. Abby's Irish Rose.
But it was indeed going to be called East Side Story. And then somebody, was like, wait a second, what if we, what's over on the West Side, though? Let's check that out. Let's go 12 blocks that way.
right.
I think it was also Lorenz was like, I know a lot more about Puerto Rican people in Harlem and stuff than I do about, I think it was originally maybe going to be Mexican and whatever. Like, yes, it is funny how they were just sort of like swapping in and out different subcommunities.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, well, which matchup works here? And obviously, it's not an Irish gang or an Italian gang, or it's just a white gang.
White guys.
I think if you're going to do West Side Story in 2021, and I think this is what Tony Kushner was thinking very hard about, it's like, it's going to be uncomfortable and interesting and much more threatening to have a movie where your heroes or a lot of your main characters are in a white gang, like, is trying to keep non-white people out of a neighborhood that essentially has been declared blighted. Like, you know, that's what happened. That's the other thing that Kushner's hit on. Like, this turf they were fighting over had already been marked for clearance, like, was just like, that's it, we're building Lincoln Center on top of this, everybody get out of here. You know, it was in the the days of New York City, especially people just kind of circling various city blocks and being like, everyone's got to move because the future's here, baby. Like, and I think that is a good way to, in my opinion, to update a musical like West Side Story without doing, say, what Ivo van Hove did on Broadway, where he was really trying to consciously make it about today, like, you know, trying to, you know, mm-hmm. bring the story into the 21st century, where it's like, that's not it, but it's just giving everything a little more context about the sort of tensions of the time without sacrificing the period, you know, the setting, like, you know, without letting go of the fact that this is the late 50s, early 60s.
Well, the problem is, like, the story, the central love story is such a fantasy that if you bring in too many realistic elements beneath the surface, like, it all falls apart. Because suddenly I'm like, you guys can't fall in love. You don't have any money. Where are you going to go? This isn't going to be a
romance.
What
are your plans?
You're going to hate each other in 5 years when Maria has 5 kids and, like, you have
no job. But that was
job.
Always... Yeah, okay, yeah, yeah. But you're saying...
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, 100%.
It takes me out of the fantasy. Whereas, you know, there's something about the original musical where I see that as wooden as they may be, you see them, you really do buy that they could have this kind of magical love that only happens in Hollywood movies from the 50s and 60s. But, I mean, you see these two people, they meet for a second at a dance, and then it's supposed to be the greatest love that has ever happened, ever, ever. And you're supposed to buy that they are completely consumed with each other to the point that when he, spoiler, murders her brother, she's like, it's fine, we're still in love. And I just did not feel that with this pairing. I thought Rachel Zegler was so fantastic, but in the scene in the gym where they meet each other, Ansel Elgort, who plays Tony, looks like he's looking at a train timetable. And just everything about the changes to that scene sort of threw a real wrench in it for me. And after that, I couldn't believe in the love story. And without that, I think the musical falls apart.
I think a lot of conversations about this movie do start with Ansel being sort of a dead fish on screen. It just, to me, like, he's distractingly bad. Like, he really, I think, poisons the well with just, like, this kind of, like, thudding impersonation he's giving of, I don't know, like, Marlon Brando or something. Like,
yeah, a little Brando-y,
you know,
soft boy Brando. Yeah,
he's just completely doing that thing of he seems like he's thinking about his role rather than just like embodying it, and it just hurts to watch.
It's just a lot more banal, like the romance in this movie. Like in the scene when they meet, I think in the original, her first line is like, "You're not thinking I'm somebody else," as if she sort of senses the connection between them, and he feels it too. And she at first assumes it's like very, it's beautiful. It's like she assumes that he knows her because it feels suddenly like they know each other at this very primal level. And then the first line in the remake version is, "I like it a lot dancing with you," or it's like, "It's funny. I wasn't planning on showing up tonight," and you're like, "Okay, cool guy."
You're not thinking I'm someone else.
I know you are not.
Funny, I wasn't planning on showing up tonight.
You don't like dancing?
No. I mean, yeah.
It's just a lot more quotidian, and I think I was really longing for this moment of, like, phantasmagorical souls meeting in the moonlight, and didn't happen.
I get all that. In the visuals, not some, you know, their performances, I think, I mean, I think she's very luminous. I think Rachel Zegler's great.
She's gorgeous. She is wonderful.
He's fine. She's just like, it's just kind of instant star shit with her. where you're just kind of, the second you see her on screen, you're like, oh, I'm rooting for this person, right? You know, you're just, she hasn't even said a word yet. And I'm like, oh, I'm on this person's side.
She's so charming.
Spielberg found her on Twitter. Is that right?
No, that's, I think, a slightly... boulderized, you know, she has gotten annoyed because she's like, I auditioned like 1,000 times. It's not like he saw one video of me. But I think there was maybe a YouTube video she sent in of her singing Tonight or somewhere, or what, you know, one of the songs. But he has said that she auditioned right, like very early in his like casting process, and that like every other Maria he saw, he was just like, I think she was better. You know, like no one ever beat her. But anyway. She was obviously unknown. This is her first film role. But no, like in the gym scene, maybe my favorite sequence in the movie, you know, Spielberg is giving you the romance. It's the lens flares and the bodies moving and the way the camera is taking the space of the viewer and all that. Like, that's where my blood's running. And obviously, Spielberg clearly reveres the movie musical. I mean, if I can... There's been more musicals of late, I would say. Like, it had gone really dead. And then, like, you know, in the last decade, there have been things like, I mean... Cats, forget Cats, you know.
La La Land,
The Greatest Showman, you know, things that are good, things that are bad, you know, things like Jersey Boys, the Mamma Mia movies, Mary Poppins Returns, In the Heights last year, which was actually really good, Dear Evan Hansen last year, which was really bad. You know, there's been a lot of swings at good musicals, I would say, and I like some of those movies, but they are horrifyingly directed. They are so poorly put together.
Uh-huh.
Even someone like Rob Marshall, who made Chicago, which was, I would say, a pretty strong movie musical, and obviously he's someone with a background in choreography. Rob Marshall made in Into the Woods, he made Mary Poppins Returns, and he stages these musical numbers where you have lots of people dancing, and the camera is cutting constantly into the action. Like, it is cutting to one person and then another. And I'm like, let me see people dancing, please. Like, stop cutting. Like, and Steven Spielberg, God bless him, holds on a wide and moves his camera around fluidly and, like, lets us actually see gorgeously choreographed musical numbers that transport your brain into a place of pure pleasure and bliss. And I wish more musicals would do that in film.
I will agree with that.
Yeah.
Another sequence I really love in this movie that is very different from the original and from the stage production is how they do Cool as a dance between Riff and Tony. And they kind of emphasize the weird connection between those two characters, right? That's sort of like they're going through a breakup. It's not just that Tony is like, you know, turning his back on the Jets or whatever. It's like that his connection with Riff is being severed as he's growing closer to Maria. And the way they're kind of like dancing and fighting at the same time, I think that's all really well done.
Well, Cool was my favorite as a kid watching West Side Story.
I mean, it's so good in the original, but the original version of it is great. Yeah,
absolutely. And there were a number of transmutations made in this movie with musical numbers where I was like, I missed the original. But with Cool, I have to say, like, they went from one incredible staging of it to a different one. And I thought that was a good example of like how to bring like the kind of darkness and violence of the story into the musical number, where they're throwing the gun around, but they're not actually like beating each other up like they end up doing in the Rumble. It's a very tense and scary scene, but it's still like a beautifully choreographed musical number.
I want to get even.
Get cool.
I want to bust.
Bust cool.
I want to go.
Go cool.
Boy, boy, crazy boy. Get cool, boy.
I want to be prepared in case they come prepared. So give me the gun, Tony. I mean it. Now.
Boy, boy, crazy boy. Get cool, boy.
I mean, yeah. I also think America is really, you know, I mean, that's sort of the most invigorating number, obviously, in the show. And they do that very well. Again, you are up against perfection. Spielberg basically says as much.
Uh-huh.
Like, he's like, the sequence in the original is unbeatable. Like, there's nothing better than that in movie musicals. But I do like their take on it a lot as well. You know, bringing it out into the street and all that.
Yeah. You have the original and they're in a contained space. They're just on that rooftop and it's just people interacting with each other. And the camera kind of stays in one spot. And that's what makes America so amazing in the original. And this one, they're like running all over the streets, like popping through fruit stands or whatever. And that, to me, that felt a little like very expected choices you would see in a recent movie musical, like this sense of like the camera is on a cherry picker or a crane. Yeah, it's really cranes doing a lot of work. Maybe a drone's in there too. And to me, that it felt, that's where like the kind of feeling of losing that sort of self-contained quality comes in.
Here you are free and you have pride.
Long as you stay on your own side.
Free to do anything you choose.
Free to wait tables and shine shoes.
Everywhere crime in America. Organized crime in America. Terrible time in America.
You forget I'm in America.
I've never loved I Feel Pretty as a song, but I loved the staging of it here in the department store. Rachel Zegler's enthusiasm is so contagious, and just her charm and her, it's just really beautifully done with the costumes and the fanciful nature of it. But I do have a problem with the placement of it, because it comes 100%. Right after you've seen these two characters brutally die. And this was the, I think it was not originally, in the original movie, it was in a slightly different
In the original movie,
location.
They moved it. It's been returned right to its original place in the show.
Yes, but in the musical, if you saw this in the theater, there would be an intermission between. You would have time to process this horrible scene of violence, and then Maria's sweet, loving excitement for her new romance. And now there's none of that. Suddenly it's just this very drastic tonal shift. I found it really hard to take, as much as I did love that scene.
It's a strange number. Sondheim despised it. Sondheim is no longer with us. And Spielberg also was going to cut it because he had the exact same reaction you had, which was, how can you have this after the rumble? And Kushner basically was like, I am putting my foot down. You absolutely have to be with Maria, in this glimpse of happiness before she finds out about her world crashing down with her, or else she's just a one-note tragic character.
I mean, no, this is the problem. If you don't have that song, there is no Maria. There's very little to her. She just doesn't have the substance.
And you need to understand why she's going to throw it all away, right? You know, you need a little more, shading for her.
I mean, you get that in the original with the placement of it earlier in the movie. You get the interiority of her. And I mean, Sondheim's anecdote about that song is that he felt bad because he didn't think the character would be singing words like witty, right? Like, he thought he was being a little too cute for the character. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Sondheim's a little grump. I love the man.
No, but he is a grump.
His whole thing with West Side Story is he's like, it's not realistic. And it's like, Steven. And he spends his whole career being like, well, I want to upend the kind of conventions of Broadway, and that's great, and I love him to death, and he's the greatest. But at the same time, it's funny that he's like, I also wrote West Side Story, which is kind of corny, and it's like, it's the greatest corny musical ever written, so congratulations, Stephen.
Yeah, Sophie, you wrote a beautiful obituary for Stephen Sondheim. How does West Side Story fit into his pantheon?
Well, it's interesting because it was one of his earliest gigs, back when he was still very much trying to make his name, and he always wanted to write his own music and lyrics. And so I think he felt that if he did West Side Story, he would be pigeonholed as just a lyricist. And he certainly was for a while. People were like, who do you think you can write music? It's not a typically Sondheimian musical, I would say. There are elements where he really comes out. I think about the song Maria, when Tony sings, sing it loud and there's music playing, say it soft and it's almost like praying. Line, I think, is really beautiful. But I feel pretty. He felt it was too twee, too charming. He didn't feel like Maria as a character, as a teenage girl, would be saying things like, it's alarming how charming I feel. But I think...
Whatever, Stephen.
I adore him.
He's
a big
grump.
Old grump.
I know. Well, we love him so much. He did actually... It surprised me because he's such a notorious grump. He told Stephen Colbert that he really loved the 2021 West Side Story, which I was shocked
by. The whole time, I think.
I didn't think he would like it at all, but...
I think this was right. This was what he wanted, is the vibe I get from this.
Really?
This. I mean, I think so, yeah.
Fascinating.
Apparently he told Rachel Zegler right before she filmed I Feel Pretty, I really dropped the ball in this song, it's no good. And she's like, okay, thanks.
I think there was also it's nice to have people who can sing, some comments like that, obviously referring to the fact that Natalie Wood was dubbed, as was Richard Boehmer in the original.
I do want to say, it's obvious that the creative team really did their work. They really wanted to do a better job with representation than the original
creative team
had done.
Non-subtitled Spanish in the film is kind of impressive and invigorating, I think.
How amazing that works, right?
It's fantastic. Well,
you understand what they're saying. It's just.
But at the same time, it's still a creative team exclusively made up of white men, which makes you see that things have actually not changed that much since 60 years ago. When you think about the people with the power to shape the ways that stories are told. Like, the difference is that they're maybe listening harder and trying harder and with more effort to incorporate voices and experience that isn't their own. But at the same time, they're still sort of the same subset of guys, which is a little depressing.
Yeah, it's completely true. Well, what do you think of what they did with Rita Moreno?
She sort of felt Shakespearean to me, almost as a character, like the elder stateswoman who's there, right, almost like the maid, you know, less comic, but she's there to sort of opine on the way things are, and also to support the characters of Tony and Maria. But I thought it was, after her, she really is the best thing about the 1961 movie, like playing Anita. She's so, so good. her dancing is just extraordinary in that film, and she brings so much to the role. She is the one who really, I think, makes Anita like the timeless character that she is. And Ariana DeBose has sort of carried on that lineage, that tradition. But it was a nice note of like, sorry, we put you in this horrible makeup all these years ago and you were still so amazing and carried this movie, and now you can have this really great role to acknowledge like the underserved, like, fantasticness of you in Hollywood throughout this time. Because she, you know, she hasn't had the roles that she's deserved in throughout her career either, but she's such an amazing performer.
Yeah, she's the best. And she seems very invested in this film, which is nice. Like, you know, she's been cheerleading for actors like David Alvarez and Ariana DeBose and Rachel Zegler and all that. Like, she's been, you know, on the press tours, and there's lots of nice behind-the-scenes footage of them all that you can find. Good vibes from all these sort of Broadway people, essentially, who are in this movie.
David, do you think that this version of West Side Story will win Oscars?
It is hotly tipped to win Best Supporting Actress for Ariana DeBose, who's very good.
She's
obviously
fantastic.
Anita is a killer role, but she's really, really great. That seems to be the only spot where I think it's probably guaranteed a victory. But I do think this movie, when it's screened for critics and stuff and the raves were so big, there was this brief moment of like, oh, is this going to be like the new Oscar frontrunner? Because it's been a bit of a weird year where there's no, you know, juggernaut. And then the film didn't do very well box office wise. And there was sort of this backlash of like, well, Steven didn't save cinemas, so I guess it's a disappointment, right? Like, well, you know, why didn't this cause everyone to rush to the theater in the middle of the Omicron wave or whatever? And, so it got 7 nominations, and it was obviously voters like it, but it does seem like it's going to be mostly an also-ran when it comes to wins.
Right. It sort of like has this weird reputation now for like underperforming. And you chalk that up to the novel coronavirus, as you might say.
That darn novel coronavirus, because obviously some movies did very well over Christmas, but films that or maybe aimed at a broader audience, more of an older audience, families, stuff like that, underperformed. It just kind of felt like, you know, the game in town during the Omicron wave was young people, because they were, you know, felt more comfortable going to a theater. But because it's Spielberg and because it's West Side Story, there was kind of the expectation of like, mm-hmm, this will be it. This will be the one that makes everyone fall back in love with the movie theaters. And instead, it kind of underperformed.
So does this mean that there'll never be another big movie musical again?
It's a good question. I mean, it's been a tough year on that regard, or 2021 was a tough year, because you had this underperform. You had In the Heights also kind of underperformed. That had a lot of buzz in the summer and, you know, again, just did a little worse than I think people expected, ticket sales wise. And then you had things like Dear Evan Hansen that underperformed in every sense. and so maybe, you know, Hollywood is always, you know, these trends come in bunches and then they'll sort of fall off. So, yeah, so maybe it'll be a few years.
I mean, what do you think would make a successful movie musical right now? Does it have to star Hugh Jackman and be about P.T. Barnum?
I mean, that was the thing about The Greatest Showman. When that came out, everyone was like, well, this is a, you know, right? This is a calamity on delivery, right? You know, who, no one wants to see an original P.T. Barnum musical, like, you know. And that film opened quite poorly and then became this kind of word of mouth sensation. So I guess that's why we have this glut now of Hollywood trying to capture that magic again. And maybe Hugh could make another big musical. There was this very popular, I don't know if you guys remember, it was sort of a hip hop musical about the founding fathers that sold some tickets on Broadway. called Hamilton that I suppose could be translated to screen one day. I don't know.
What happened after La La Land? Like, that movie was such a cultural phenomenon, it felt like, at the time, that I was sure that we would see waves of contemporary movie original, musicals set in fantasy dreamland Hollywood land, but it never happened.
Yeah, it didn't quite happen, did it? I mean, like, La La Land it was really tricky to pull it off. They made an original musical starring two very charming and famous actors who are not particularly strong singers or dancers. God bless them. I like the movie a lot, but you know, you're not coming to the movie to hear Ryan Gosling sing. And it was a genuine hit. Like, it was not just an Oscar hit. It was not just well received. It made like $500 million worldwide. Like, it is. It's really tough to pull something like that off, right? Like, it's just a lot to chew. But Hollywood will always take swings at making musicals because the potential. Like what's happening with Encanto right now, right? Obviously, it's an animated musical, but like the potential of having the multiple streams of revenue, you know, having a hit soundtrack, having songs that, you know, take on a life of their own is obviously huge.
Like, it feels like there's like a lot of potential there to make the like really like MTV-ized or whatever, like super contemporary audiovisual swirling crazy thing that like West Side Story must have felt like in 1961, that doesn't try to be a movie. Like, it tries to be like an overwhelming, like,
I would say something like Moulin Rouge.
Yeah, but that would be like the other one I would mention.
Where it's like, this is not going to be going for evoking Broadway. This is evoking.
Yeah.
This is a very heady, very visually overloaded, like, you know, cinema experience. And I love Moulin Rouge, personally. I don't know how.
Yeah, that was like 20 years ago now.
It's 20 years ago. We're old. We're old as dirt. It's 21 years as
sick of that narrative. Yeah.
What, that we're old?
Sick of the passage of time.
Doesn't Baz Luhrmann have a new movie coming out this year?
He sure does. It's about a little singer you might have heard of by the name of Elvis. You know that guy? Heard of him?
Vulture had the best headline for when the trailer dropped for that movie. Tom Hanks got COVID for this.
I love Baz Luhrmann, and I'll be front row center every 10 years when he decides to make a movie. When that trailer dropped, and I love Tom Hanks, you know, I'm rooting for him too. But Tom Hanks busting out that Dutch accent to play Tom Parker, I was like, I don't know about this. Like, we might be in trouble for minute one. I don't know. We'll see.
All right. Well, let's wrap today with a closing question. And my question for you, since we've talked about this very ambitious film adaptation of a musical, is what musical do you most want to see put on screen?
I have an answer for this, but it's a slight twist. I want an adaptation of Company, but I also am very happy for it just to be the adaptation of Company that was done at the Public. Wait, David, you know this. Was it done for charity? And it was for like a couple nights only, and Neil Patrick Harris was in it and Stephen Colbert.
Yeah, that wasn't at the Public. It was at Lincoln Center, but it was really good. And I did see it and love it. Now, I'm only mad because that's my answer too. I had always dreamed of Hugh Jackman in a Company film because when he emerged as an actor who was also, you know, capable of like Tony winning performances on Broadway, I was like, well, here, this is your guy. Like, he's the right age. He's the right sort of profile to do Robert. Like, and then it just never happened. And now I feel like Hugh Jackman's like a little too old, obviously, like to be, you know, the 40-year-old.
Turning 30.
Right. I mean, 30. Yeah. You know, like, so now I'm not sure who that, like, because like for a something like Company, right? It's like you need some major star you can hitch it to, right? I guess Jake Gyllenhaal, right? Like, he's someone who's emerged as like a guy who can do Broadway. Probably he did a very good
Sunday in the Park.
Right.
Sunday in the Park.
So, you know, maybe him. Even he's getting a bit old, obviously.
No, but, I would watch that. That's inspired casting. But mostly I just I want that version back on YouTube because there were so many times when I would feel sad and I would
Neil make Patrick myself Harris one?
Feel yeah, I would make myself yeah. feel better by watching Stephen Colbert sing Sorry Grateful, and someone has removed all the videos and I don't have that in my life anymore.
You,
so
I think you can maybe purchase it or something. I think it does exist in some form. But yeah, I love money? That production. Yeah, I know, you gotta cha-ching.
Spend money.
I remember when I saw that production, it had very much been billed as like, look, it's for charity and everyone will be, you know, probably on book and, you know, we've cast all these famous people. So like, there was sort of the vibe of like, don't get your expectations too high. And then I saw it and I was like, this is basically like a Broadway, you know, like
yeah.
they're off book. They're really good. Like I would watch this 10 times. So yeah, I did love that production.
Sorry, I stole your answer.
Well, we both said company though. Jeez, now we have to think of something else.
David, you got to pick another.
Like I've always wondered why there wasn't like a Urine Town adaptation. Like why those cool early 2000s musicals that came post Rent,
right? Avenue Q. You know,
Avenue Q, I God bless it, like does feel a little rooted right in its time, right? Like I'm not sure Avenue Q would work anymore. But like yeah, Avenue Q is certainly another one. Those like self-aware without sacrificing, you know, the power of a Broadway musical shows, right? Like why I guess because like movie musicals were very uncool in the early 2000s. Like maybe that's why they never kind of got their shot at cinema.
But wasn't that the time when Chicago and Moulin Rouge?
Well, Chicago is 2002. And I do think that, yeah, that revives interest in the more classic, right? You know, like song and dance movie. But yeah,
there's never been a Book of Mormon movie, right? Am I wrong?
There hasn't. I feel like with a lot of those, and this is the same with Wicked, right? Like the producers of the show get a little like edgy about like, well, when should we make the movie? Because won't that hurt the show?
Yeah.
Like won't people? And so then you have this weird problem where Rent, the movie comes out and they use the original cast and everyone's like way too old. And you're like, oh, this is like embarrassing. And the same in the producer's movie, which just came a little too late. And everyone was like, eh, we're kind of over this. Like this isn't interesting anymore. And I think that's what happened with Wicked, which has never been movie-fied. It's probably going to happen to Hamilton, right? You know, a lot of these huge hits just get kind of shelved and they're waiting for some moment that maybe doesn't exist.
Hence all the comments about Ben Platt's CGI face in Dear Evan Hansen.
That's a great example. Like where like you could do a Dear Evan Hansen, but yeah, Ben Platt's too old now, but they are like, Well, we can't not do it with Ben Platt, right? He was the reason the show did so. Like, you know, they get caught in this weird logic thing of like, yeah. Well, we've waited too long, but also we have to do the original. Like, I would love to see a film version of Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812, which is like one of the great Broadway shows of the last decade. I don't know how you do that in a movie, but I'd love someone to take a swing. That'd be cool.
Spencer, what's yours?
I'm going to give a total Philistine answer as someone who's not really too steeped in musical history, but the one that really I did love as a child was Phantom of the Opera, and I know it was made into a 2004 movie.
It was, sure.
Dun, dun, I know dun, that people dun, dun, dun. Hate it.
You mean hate the show or hate the movie?
Gerard Butler was in that, wasn't he? Am I making that
Gerard
up?
Gerard Butler, it's true.
I know that it ruined Broadway or whatever, but I think it's time for like a really like heavy metal goth version of it. Just a steamroll culture. I could really see that happening.
Okay.
It was so disappointing, that movie, especially since Joel Schumacher is a hack, but God rest his soul, he's not with us anymore. but he was always, you know, he made like the later Batman movies or whatever. You were like, at least the man understands camp and big production value. And then that movie, I remember, I saw it, I just remember it feeling like a little, you know, dull and kind of perfunctory. So yeah, it's sort of too bad. It should have been, you know, 500% over the top. That's the only way you're going to do that, right? Yeah.
100%. Yep. That's what I want. All right. Well, that's it for our show. The Review is produced by Kevin Townsend with help from AC Valdez. The executive producer of Atlantic Podcasts is Claudine Abade. And our art is by Charlie LaMignon. I'm Spencer Kornhaber. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sophie.
Thanks, Spencer.
Keep it cool.